Hello and welcome to the EMJ podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Today, I'm joined by Professor Madhuri Hegde, Senior Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer at Revoteam, formerly PerkinElmer. After graduating with both an undergraduate and master's degree in microbiology and genetics from the University of Bombay, Madhuri made the move to New Zealand to complete a PhD in applied science at the University of Auckland. Since then, Madhuri has worked with several academic institutions in New Zealand and the United States, with her research focusing on muscular dystrophy, dysferlinopathies, and newborn screening, earning her certification as a diplomat in clinical molecular genetics by the American Board of Medical Genetics and the role of fellow from the American College of Medical Genetics. Professor Hegde is a recognized and highly respected leader in the field of clinical genomics and has presented over 100 keynote presentations at national and international conferences, as well as being credited as an author or co-author on more than 150 peer-reviewed publications and 8 book chapters. Reciting even a small example of her list of honors and appointments would easily consume this entire podcast and probably another to follow. Madhuri then made the jump to industry, becoming Chief Scientific Officer at Revvity and heading Revvityomics, a network of laboratories across the globe, while maintaining academic appointments as adjunct faculty at Georgia Institute of Technology and Emory University School of Medicine, which I've had the pleasure of visiting. Madhuri is inspired by the spirit of humans to keep exploring, and as a result is a leader who's passionate about harnessing science to positively impact human health. It should come as little surprise that this passion extends to her hobbies, as her fiery support for Indian cricket and keen sense of competition are well known to her family and colleagues alike. She has a very young granddaughter, so much of her outside time goes in helping her daughter, who's in her final year of a pediatric nephrology fellowship, and is about to take on a faculty position as a physician scientist. She practices yoga and pranayama, Sanskrit for deep breathing, and she also walks for an hour every day. Good on her. She's recently focused on diet purification and cooks almost every day. We were having a wee chat beforehand about Indian cuisine, one of my faves. When younger, Madhuri held some exhibitions of her art and learned to play the sitar, which is a hypnotic Indian musical instrument that she plans to get back to sometime soon. Given how accomplished this fascinating lady is, I would not be surprised if Professor Hegde picked up the baton from the late, great Ravi Shankar. Professor Madhuri Hegde, it's an honor to have you here with us today. I'm very much looking forward to our chat.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction, Jonathan.
I have to tell you, just as I was talking about the sitar, one of the first movies Peter Sellers made was called The Party. And it's all about a young Indian actor trying to make his way in Hollywood. And this man is a disaster wherever he goes. But the thing has a very 1960s soundtrack featuring a lot of sitar. And I just had this wonderful sort of reverie thinking about it. I read that your interest in genomics was sparked at an early age by a video on DNA extraction during a sixth grade science class. How did you nurture that curiosity, which led to a career focusing on genomic technologies?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Jonathan. It really starts with my family background, deeply rooted in science, specifically in medicine and pharma. And then going on to having many entrepreneurs in my family. Growing up, this constant exposure to critical thought discussions and learning, and thereby generating new ideas. Now, when I think of it, had been a constant feature of as I was growing up. And this really afforded the opportunity to expand my horizons. Science being all around me, with my paternal grandmother starting in science and then going on through the entire family, really helped me nurture this curiosity. And then that eventually led me into kind of finding my own path into where I want to be, And that led to formally then getting trained in genetics and genomics.
So thank you for that. As mentioned during my introduction, one of your primary research interests is newborn screening, specifically for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, an inherited form of muscular dystrophy. Although our audience are primarily healthcare providers, we also have many interested members of the lay public who listen in. So first, please give us an overview about Duchenne. And can you then please outline your research into next generation screening for this disease?
Sure. So let's. So I'm going to divide this answer in two parts. One is just talk about Duchenne, and then the work I have done in Duchenne and continue to work on it. So Duchenne muscular dystrophy is a, and the short form usually used is DMD, is X-linked. So the gene lies on the X chromosome. Severe inherited muscular dystrophy caused by the mutations in the DMD gene. And it thereby usually affects boys. Girls can be affected, but that is rare. The primary indication leads to muscle loss and weakness. The symptoms start appearing between the ages of 2 and 5, and most boys with DMD need a wheelchair by the time they're teenagers. So the early symptoms include walking later than average, large calves, weakness in shoulders, upper arms, hip and thigh muscles. Now, DMD is probably one of the more common genetic conditions. It affects about 1 in 3,500 to 5,000 male newborns. Females are usually carriers, and as I said earlier, they can be affected, though rare. But there is no specific high risk for any ethnic group. It is pretty much universal. This incidence rate I mentioned is pretty much universal. Boys with DMD usually live into their 20s or 30s and usually pass away with cardiorespiratory failure. That is usually the main cause of death. Now, today, while there is no cure for DMD, a variety of treatments can help manage the condition. And this is where my work comes in. So newborn screening, we all know that relies on being able to detect a primary biomarker for any given disorder that is included in the newborn screening list of disorders, where early intervention can lead, help the individual lead a near normal life. So though DMD does not have a primary biomarker, creatine kinase is kind of a surrogate marker which can help indicate the possibility of a neuromuscular disorder, including DMD. In a newborn screening, we were able to get a FDA-approved kit for evaluating creatine kinase. Now, taking that further with my interest in neuromuscular disorders, the one additional feature about DMD is it's the largest gene in the human genome. The technology has evolved significantly, and I'm going to use words like multiplex PCR, MLPA, Sanger, but today, next-generation sequencing has become the go-to technology to use for testing for DMD. And now the next one is RNA sequencing. So essentially looking at this pathway of how the gene was identified, then using CK or creatine kinase as a biomarker to see if it is elevated, and then going on to testing and looking for mutations in the DMD gene. Now, when I say newborn screening, obviously that thought comes that the earlier you identify, the better the opportunity for early intervention.
So I just want to go back to something you said, talking about the genetics. It's an X-linked disease, and you said girls get it. Normally with these, you know, my genetics harks back to my time at medical school many moons ago, but X-linked diseases tend to affect men because if it's homozygous, if it's on both X chromosomes, it tends to be fatal. How does it work in this disease in females?
Sure. So in males, it is hemizygous with one X chromosome. In females, because there's a second X there, it tends to balance out. So we call it the random X inactivation, that even if the mutation is there on the X chromosome, that X chromosome gets inactivated. So girls remain carriers and they can pass it on to their children when they decide to reproduce. But in some cases, we have this phenomenon called skewed X inactivation, where the X chromosome on which the mutation is not inactivated, and thereby the girls can manifest the condition. Now, what has been noticed is in girls, usually you can get a cardiac manifestation, or in carriers, basically also some level of cardiac manifestation can be there. And there's plenty of research that has been published on this. So carriers can be also monitored, especially in their 20s and 30s as they progress through life.
Okay, fascinating. Thanks for that. So can you explain how your passion for this led to your role at Revvity, which was the first clinical laboratory to offer whole genome sequencing on a commercial basis, right?
Yes. So as you mentioned in my introduction, you know, I'm originally from India, went to New Zealand to finish my PhD, then came to Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, did my postdoc there, and then went on to run the Emory Genetics Laboratory at Emory University. At that time, I also always had my research laboratory, and I was funded with grants and things like that. But I spent most of my career in academia. But though in academia, I was running a clinical laboratory, which was competing in the commercial space. So I was very much at this, border between academia and industry. And I had that great opportunity at Emory University. When I came to Perkin-Elmer at that time, and now Revvity, one of the biggest things I kind of realized is that when I was running Emory Genetics Lab, we used to get samples from all over the world. But at Revvity, we have a global laboratory network with labs in different countries. Now, this really helped us develop this in-country, for-country approach where, you know, with the deep clinical expertise, our ability to manufacture was able to lead this transformation in healthcare towards whole genome sequencing. And, you know, even with next generation sequencing, things have evolved significantly. You know, when we started the first next generation sequencing test for X-linked conditions when I was at Emory in 2010, to now where we can actually use and the whole genome sequence interrogate it, both in healthy babies and sick at the same time, and really use that to advance healthcare. So that's really kind of the transition and the kind of the journey from running a clinical laboratory in a private university to industry, and which helped me bring whole genome sequencing in a commercial launch to offer as a commercial test, basically.
Right. So in a similar vein, you've recently launched ultra rapid genomic testing to aid with the treatment, the evaluation and treatment of critically ill patients in the neonatal and pediatric intensive care settings. What are some of the future opportunities and challenges associated with this very exciting technology?
Yeah, truly, it's really transformational. If you look at, and let's just take a step back a little bit, you know, if you look at newborn screening, it's really a preventive approach that you catch the condition before onset, intervene, and thereby, you know, really impact that individual's health. The same approach then now you can expand into for a sick baby by doing ultra-rapid genome sequencing, or both in neonatal and pediatric settings, where you run the genome in a very rapid fashion. And today we can deliver results in under 5 days. Our turnaround time today sits around 48 hours. But what that really means is that the physician has access to the data very early on so that they can modify the treatments or bring in new approaches to treatment. So we are truly talking about personalized approach to treatments. Another very important aspect of this technology is that once you have generated the genome data, it stays there for perpetuity unless you want to destroy it. And what does that essentially mean is that you can revisit the data throughout that individual's lifetime for any other events and compare that data. Now, the next level is obviously looking at the metabolic level or the biochemical markers, but that is obviously the next level. At the DNA level, the data will always stay and allows you the ability to keep improvising, keep bringing in new approaches to healthcare.
So I'd like to change focus slightly. Your research surrounding neuromuscular disorders has contributed to a number of pharmaceutical drug discovery programs, such as the Lantern Project. Can you please summarize that work for our listeners?
So going back to my PhD days, where I really got my first exposure to Duchenne muscular dystrophy or DMD, and you know, starting to develop this diagnostic testing strategies for DMD, that eventually kind of led on to my full-fledged research in neuromuscular disorders. Now, as the human genome got sequenced, one of the things that started happening very rapidly in the last two decades or so is new genes started getting identified. And one of the biggest learnings that we have all had in medicine with this whole concept of genomic medicine is that one gene can cause many disorders, and many genes can cause one disorder. Now, this is a very important concept, and especially for the pharmaceutical industry, which is now starting to develop new drugs for not just common conditions, but also for rare conditions. So this is where also this collaboration on this Lantern project with Genzyme Sanofi started. And it actually started when I was at Emory for Pompe disease, and then eventually extended out to other neuromuscular conditions. Again, keeping in mind the same concept that one gene, many disorders, many genes, one disorder. Now this, you can take the same concept and extend it out to therapeutics, because the Lantern project essentially helps us understand the true incidence of disease, also understand the broad clinical spectrum, which helps the physicians as they are examining a patient. It's very difficult to narrow down on a gene, but looking at that whole group of genes or the whole group of disorders has really been this beautiful outcome of the Lantern project. We have already published now four papers from these last studies. We have tested over 10,000 patients and really been able to, you know, produce that data, which is useful for both the pharmaceutical industry, but also the physicians.
Right. So, from my understanding, which is limited, lack of diversity in genetic databases is an ongoing issue. As Revvity provides families and healthcare partners with access to multi-omic-derived diagnostic technologies in over 155 countries, does that seem like a rational way to overcome this problem?
So, you know, there are different, obviously, there are very different, many different approaches that are always are getting published. There's a lot of discussion about how do we create diversity in our databases. And I want to go back to my Emory days where I actually started publishing on this specific topic. We had gone ahead. So Emory Genetics Laboratory was the first, one of the first genetics laboratories globally. And so we had a whole sort of treasure trove of all the work we had done there. Bringing that into a database format, which we started there, was not a trivial exercise. But as I started getting involved more and more into the community and understanding what the issues are, got heavily involved with the NIH ClinVar effort, the ClinGen effort, it was very clear that the databases are a key and very important aspect of how we are going to bring genome sequencing into healthcare, because the more different types of variants we discover, we identify in individuals, we have to be able to interpret them. So as I mentioned earlier, we used to get samples at Emory from all over the world, but with this global footprint approach has really dramatically changed how we can create a global database. And this is where I think we have to take that next step now. In ClinVar today, which is an NIH effort, variants are getting deposited from all over the world. The Revvity footprint and our own database has a global diversity, which means that when we look at the whole genome data, we have the ability to interpret that data, looking at that individual's background, the origin, so that we can actually compare the data to the right population set. This is still evolving. I think we need a lot more data to go into different databases, and our database will also continue to grow with our global footprint.
Right. So sort of looking into the future a bit, what new trends or technologies do you think we're going to see in this area over the next few years?
So it's really an amazing time we are living in. You know, starting with my training at Baylor College of Medicine, and then at that time, we were doing Sanger sequencing. To today, in a short span of about 15 years, we have made tremendous advances. I think the next steps are going to be, the way I view it is, genomic medicine is going to sit front and center amongst all the faculties of medicine, because it really is very important to understand the genetic background of an individual. But in terms of technologies, if you take that genomic medicine, and we accept that if genomic medicine is going to sit front and center, then how do these technologies and what are the trends that are going to really evolve? I think the one thing is a shift from short read sequencing is what we do today, is sequence short pieces of DNA, about 150 base pairs to 200 base pairs, to go to long read. And by that, I mean several KBs. I think that shift is happening. It has started. But also a definite shift towards functional genomics, which is really important, because that is going to give us that guide, that indication of whether a new therapeutic strategy is having any impact or not. So we are going to see developments of point of care technologies and assays. And probably in terms of a laboratory setting, you're going to see this resurgence and importance of mass spec becoming really broad and wide across the spectrum to go with the genomic technologies.
Yeah, your first comment about being an exciting time, and you mentioned a short while back Pompe disease. I knew some folks who were working in that space a number of years ago, and it's fascinating to see that kind of disease be identified and therapies sought for something that affects a tiny number of people. Absolutely fascinating. So changing topics again, between 2020 and 2022, you directed 3 COVID-19 testing laboratories for the good old National Health Service, the NHS in the UK, and the California Department of Public Health in America, which together processed, wait for it, approximately 16 million samples. How did you tackle such a massive task during the pandemic? And how do you think that this experience has shaped your career since, and how we prepare ourselves for the inevitable next pandemic?
If I were to answer to this question in two words, I would say teamwork, right? But I'll give you a slightly longer version of that. Obviously, COVID, really sort of brought so many changes to how we actually approach healthcare. There's been a lot of learning that has happened across the board in, are we prepared to handle anything like this? At Revvity, we had the COVID testing kit. And in the early days of COVID, when FDA evaluated all the testing kits across the board, the Revvity testing kit came up right at the top with the highest sensitivity. And by that, I mean, we were able to detect 20 copies per mil. So that was a very exciting time for us, that we had been able to develop such a kit. But now that we, given that we had this global laboratory footprint, it was an opportunity for us to how we can help individuals get tested. And then these two opportunities emerged. I think the one thing which we learned during COVID, and especially at Revvity, is this agile work environment. And this is kind of the extension of teamwork I'm talking about. Right from manufacturing the kits, shipping the kits, quality and regulatory, hiring individuals in a clinical laboratory, as you know, requires a tremendous amount of effort because you're looking for some specific talent there. And then travel, which was not easy. And we were doing it because in the US, our laboratory is in Pittsburgh. So we were setting up a lab in California and in the UK. Having this trained individuals who were in the part of my leadership team, who were able to go across both these laboratories and set up these labs. And by that, I mean, we actually went and looked for starting, especially in California, looking for space and building the laboratory from ground up. The California Department of Health really did a tremendous job, setting up and outfitting a space for you to be used as a laboratory. But taking from sort of taking that and then hiring individuals, getting a test validated, launching it, and as you mentioned, we did over approximately 16 million samples, was a tremendous effort. You know, how it shaped my career, I think first thing is, you know, I've always thought that, you know, training individuals is how I sort of pass it on forward. And it really helped me understand this is the right way to do it. You have to nurture talent and support people so that they can grow in their own careers. And coming from a very much a university setting, I truly believe in that. But also the other aspect of, you know, sort of learning in all of this is that there is no replacement for collaboration, talking across the board, generating ideas so that we can actually all work together and bring it to sort of help, you know, mankind and, you know, improve our healthcare systems. Traveling, and one last thing I would mention is because we are talking about, you know, how we are going to prepare ourselves for the next pandemic. I think something as simple as travel and the impact on travel was really astounding. And that really tells us that it is not just developing these diagnostic assays or, you know, starting laboratories, but we have to create an infrastructure and an ecosystem which is ready to take on the next pandemic. And that really starts, again, going back to, you know, developing tools which are point of care, you know, which can actually help individuals who are not able to get out and get tested. So a lot of learnings. And again, I'll end this answer by saying, really is teamwork and collaboration.
Yeah, I am. Your observations scream to me of someone who is a citizen of the world. You're from India, you're educated in New Zealand, you're working in the United States, you have a global view. I've heard the expression that someone sneezes in, well, let's be politically correct and avoid dispute. Someone sneezes in Edinburgh, someone in San Francisco catches a cold. But great observations. Majuri, finally, a question I like to ask every guest that comes on here. If a magic genie could grant you three wishes in your field of healthcare, or frankly, any field of healthcare, what would they be?
You know, as you just mentioned, I'm truly a global citizen, having lived in three different countries. And the first thing that comes to my mind is that equitable access to healthcare. Yeah. You know, in my day-to-day job, and also the opportunities have sort of have come my way, I've been able to travel a lot, going across the globe. And this is probably the most important thing, which, you know, if I could do something, is, you know, having equitable access to healthcare is absolutely critical. But then that goes on to the next wish, which is a focus on preventive and personalized medicine than symptomatic medicine. You know, you mentioned in my introduction this whole sort of journey I have embarked upon about diet purification, yoga, and pranayama. It really is about preventive medicine. You know, programs such as newborn screening, they are really important because they make a dramatic change in the sort of the investment we need to make into the healthcare system. And obviously personalized medicine, which is also very important because we are all different, a little different. We are 99% similar, 1% difference, but that difference is enough to demand a different kind of a pathway or any kind of treatment I might receive. And the third thing I would mention is an unbiased approach to development of care pathways, especially for rare diseases. The European Organization of Rare Diseases estimates that about 3 to 4% of the world's population is affected by one of the approximately 6,000 to 7,000 distinct rare diseases. Now, if you just take that and calculate it, then this really corresponds to about 300 to 400 million people. The reason I mention this is that the rare diseases can also be a key to unraveling novel disease pathways and treatment strategies, not just for rare conditions, but for common conditions as well. So these are really my three wishes, but it starts with equitable access to healthcare.
Well, again, that's a very noble wish. You're one very impressive lady, and I shall be looking out for that album of sitar music. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank Professor Madhuri Hegde for being with us today. It was a real pleasure to chat with you. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me on this podcast and to European Medical Journal as well. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. So, folks, please subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Check out the archives. There's loads of great content on there. Please join us next week for another fascinating episode. And until then, I'm Dr. Jonathan Sackier, and I thank you for listening to the EMJ podcast. Please stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.